That's Freddie Hubbard on trumpet opening I Heard That with the Paul Chambers Quintet, featuring Cannonball Adderley on alto sax, Wynton Kelly on piano, Jimmy Cobb on drums, and the great Paul Chambers himself on bass. It's from his 1959 album, Go. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today it's all about Detroit. Almost all, 94, in fact, of Detroit's 97 public schools are closed today, the result of a sick-out by teachers reacting to news over the weekend that the state won't be able to pay them after June the 30th, when emergency aid to the bankrupted city runs out. But Elena Herrada, a very familiar voice here on Lead Stories, who has been walking us through the impact of bankruptcy, that forced bankruptcy in Detroit, is an elected member of the school board whose authority over local education was overridden during the imposed bankruptcy. She says the sick-out protest is, in fact, a publicity stunt that is meant to cover up the union's complicity in the main objective, which is destroying the public education system in Detroit. Thanks, Elena, for joining us today. That's quite a thing to say. So what is the situation now? All these schools are closed, and this is supposed to be a statement by the unionized teachers about the issue of pay. This is pay they supposedly already have earned, and the emergency manager, who used to be the judge in the bankruptcy case, is now saying there will be no money come June 30th. After June 30th, there'll be no money. So heaven knows how the teachers will continue to get paid. But why are you suspecting that this is a publicity stunt on the part of the teachers?
Well, because first of all, this sick out was called by the union. And the last sick out got them all hauled into court. And with the legislature in Michigan trying to come up with ways to outlaw sick outs. So the teachers union was really seriously admonished by the state. And they claimed that they did not orchestrate the sick out, but, you know, the teachers had a sick out. There was a union president who was elected who was a very contested figure, but also was the only one that was pretty militant in calling for the restoring of the elected school board. And he was ousted, and the local was trusteed. And the local was trusteed by people who are very friendly with the Snyder administration and very friendly with the Duggan administration and are amenable to mayoral takeover of the schools, which is the shorthand for privatization and charters. So the union, which was very much on the hot seat for the sick out that was held last, now called for a sick out when Judge Rhodes issued a statement that teachers who had worked all year and who are on the spread the pay, you know, when you get paid during the summer for the and you're not working. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you're on like a 26 week pay period, but you work 10 months. So it's your money. You just put it in the bank, which was the district. They're telling them that they're not going to get their summer pay, and that there won't be summer school and there won't be special ed. So teachers that were in...
Oh, we're having a little trouble with you, Elena. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. There was some interference, but...
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Going.
Okay. So the teachers who were on the summer pay, they spread their pay and took less home each week. And they've already sacrificed up to $20,000 in pay, in concessions and loans to the district. Some of them are bringing home $350 a week. So the teachers have no
margin of error. They've cut and cut and cut. And they also changed their health care because there was a lucrative contract for one of the emergency manager's wife who was on the board of a health care provider. So they changed their health care to her company mid-contract, which cost the teachers a lot more in money and much reduced benefits. None of that could be done but for an emergency manager being there. So they've been hit and hit and hit, and their working conditions are horrific. Some of them have 45 students in a classroom. Many do not have textbooks or the supplies that are needed, and turnover is so terribly high, which, you know, really makes student behaviors almost impossible to deal with when there's constantly new teachers, because there's no stability for the students. So the situation is really dire in the schools, in the remaining schools that are open.
Which brings me to the question about the function. I mean, you are an elected member of the school board.
Right.
The power and authority of the school board was just superseded by the judge in this case, vis-a-vis the order to install an emergency manager who essentially was the chief potentate of Detroit, making all of the decisions whether people were elected to office or not.
Right.
How has it been the case that you continue, though elected, you continue not to have any input at all on this question of the people's control of education and educational issues in Detroit?
Well, that's the first question, and hold that question in mind. Why are they so hell-bent on getting rid of us and replacing us when we have no authority, we have no money, we have absolutely no resources, and we were elected, and we have 2 and 4 years left in our terms, respectively, for the district and the at-large? So I'm not up until 2017, and the others are not up until 2019, but they're going to hold elections as if we're not here, in order to be able to get the people that they want to be on the board. Very similar to Chicago, which has an appointed board, which, you know, there's people going to prison in Chicago over the indictments. And the same people who were here in Detroit, one, Barbara Bird Bennett, the chief accountability officer, I love their names of things. It's like, you know, a chief accountability officer read a contract for textbooks for $45 million here. It was the highest amount of money ever spent on textbooks in our history. And she had worked for the I think it was Houghton Mifflin. She had worked for them before coming here. The emergency manager brought her aboard. She got this textbook deal, which were not able to be used in Detroit because they were already 10 years old and still in the packages. But she got this sweet deal with her previous employer and got a huge kickback from it. Then went on to Chicago. But Chicago still has media that investigates. And it was actually a blogger that kept at it. And she was eventually indicted and she's now in jail. But nobody here that did those kinds of things, those major crimes, is going to jail. We got the 13 principals with a combined $2 million in gift cards all facing prison time. And so, I mean, the heist is going on right in front of us with everybody involved in it, from Duggan to Judge Rhodes. They're all involved in making sure that the contractors get the first crack at the money that comes in, and that's why they want to remove any public oversight. So that's what's in the hopper. The thing that I'm trying to articulate for people who are not familiar with the emergency manager laws is that every black city in the state of Michigan or black school district is under emergency management. It's Public Act 436, where elected officials are stripped of authority and the state has full authority. That's how Flint got poisoned, was because the Flint City Council was not allowed to make any decisions on behalf of their own population. The emergency manager who was over Flint, Darnell Early, was then transferred to Detroit Public Schools, and he's still on the payroll for over $80,000, and he doesn't have anything to do. He has nothing to do. He has no real job. In the meantime, people whose jobs are empty, like the ones who hold the hearings for suspensions, there's only 2 people that do that for the entire district. While we're under zero tolerance, which means that we have thousands of kids out of school, and nobody knows where they are. We have children just missing. So the point of
the emergency manager in the corporate takeover is basically one to destabilize the city, to destabilize the communities, so that people have to leave the neighborhoods where they live and go find a school, with the bottom line being ethnic cleansing. This is a black city, and it managed to get a white mayor who did not live in the city, who was a write-in mayor, and he was able to pull in all of these major, major corporations, and they really just basically have no plan for all these black people that are here, especially poor people. That's really the bottom line of what's going on here. And the previous host that you had on your show was talking about how if you repeat something enough, you just simply make it true. There were weapons of mass destruction. Well, Detroit is incompetent and corrupt. The people don't deserve the right to govern themselves, and they shouldn't have access to all that money. We'll do better with it. We'll take it over. Give it to us, and we'll hint. That's really what the narrative has been here. It's very easy to do to a black city. It's very easy to do because they've been, you know, they've been leading up to it for generations since Coleman Young.
It is mind-boggling because we've been following Detroit now for 2 years and more. And we keep saying there is a template here that is being tested and perfected in order to be applied across the board, across the nation. And I guess at some point people might have said, you know, that's kind of exaggerating things. It really isn't that bad, or it might be bad, but it is limited to Detroit, and Detroit's situation is kind of singular. It's unique,
right.
But it certainly is not something that applies across the country. What do you say?
Well, for the listeners, I hope that you know that the first plaintiff for the Flint water case was shot and killed in her home. A 19-year-old woman and a mother of one, a child who was extremely lead poisoned. She was shot and killed in her house, along with her housemate, who was also a plaintiff. And the same weekend, the man who worked for the Flint Water Department, who was an engineer, who had testified about the water, was found dead with no explanation of his death. He was 43 years old. So three people who were very instrumental to the case pending were found dead. And Governor Snyder, who was the lightning rod of all this, had made an announcement, a public like relations kind of scheme announcement, that he was going to drink Flint water for 30 days. But instead, right after that announcement came out and he made this big press conference and said that he was going to drink the Flint water for 30 days, he ends up going to Europe. He had to go to Europe on a business trip, and these people were killed. And so you can't make this up, but it's the people who are involved in contesting it are in grave danger. They're in grave danger. Like for people to just suddenly die who were going to be a major part of this, it's just, and in the meantime, not one pipe has been replaced. Not one pipe in Flint has been replaced, but Snyder is spending millions on public relations and lawyers. He hired a law firm that's costing us millions, and he hired a public relations firm. And the strategy of the firm, which was leaked, was that they were going to start talking about how every city in Michigan is really lead poisoned. That was their strategy, was to take the focus and diffuse it off of Flint. But Flint was the only city that was forced to go on the Flint River water, which was contaminated by General Motors, which didn't have to be on the water. So you can't separate the difference between the emergency manager over Flint and Detroit Public Schools. Not only is it the same people, but it's a narrative that's able to be used because the people are black. It's because the people are black. And in this case, you could interchange poor and black, because both the people in Detroit Public Schools and the residents of Flint are poor people. Mostly, they're there because, their industry left, which was General Motors. and left thousands and thousands of people jobless. But they own property there, and that's their home. I mean, people have lived for generations there. So they, and their homes are now worth pennies, so they don't have any way out. But there's no relocation plan for the people who are there, who are still drinking that water and who are being bombarded by do-gooders bringing bottled water. But they still don't have the water infrastructure to take showers or drink the water safely. And Snyder, in the meantime, is traveling to Europe holding press conferences. Not one pipe has been put in the ground to replace the lead pipes. Not one. So the situation here is one of racial genocide. It's racial genocide. It's people being killed off through either poison, in some cases bullets, but also through having education stripped away. There is no education going on in Detroit. So that's the situation on the ground here. I have absolutely not a modicum of trust or respect for the teachers union for getting involved with this legislation that would strip us permanently of having elected board members. This means that there would be a financial review board, the same as over the city council in Detroit, over the schools permanently. That's what the AFT got in bed with. They agreed to that, and they're trying to get members to agree to it, and they're sending out all kinds of information to everyone telling people to support Senate Bills 710 and 711, which disenfranchises Detroit.
But Elena, you're saying this as an activist. You've been involved in educational
I've also been a union president. I've been a union representative. I come out of the House of Labor. I've been everything you can be in a union. I come from three generations of our whole time in this country, in the U.S. I come from union families of union activists. And I've been a union president, representative, member, organizer. I've been everything. I was taught organizing by Cesar Chavez and the people who actually they weren't perfect, but there was some principles involved. So I can inside view. I'm not anti-union by any means.
But what is happening in Detroit is, as you say, is a gathering of forces that one would have assumed would have nothing in common. I mean, you would never think that the teachers' union would have anything in common with corporate interests or would have anything in common.
I guess you have never met Randy Weingarten.
Okay. Could you explain how these forces came together and what is the benefit and how is it that in Michigan, as you have noted, every single black city is under emergency management, and yet we don't see across the United States a hue and cry about how could this possibly be?
No. And this is because people accept the narrative. The people accept the narrative that black people cannot govern themselves. I just wrote a post on my Facebook, which is, sort of notorious. I just wrote a post saying I wish the people who had gotten involved in the anti-apartheid movements in South Africa would descend upon Detroit in the way that people did then. But we have a completely apartheid structure here. We have every city, and some of them are some of the black cities that are under PA 436 are in much better financial shape than the white cities that did not get taken over. So to say even that would be unfair to say that, well, they were poor, so they got taken over, because black cities are more poor than white cities, because black people are more poor than white people. But it's just the idea that they would do this narrative of us not being able to govern ourselves, but the damage that it does to generations is, I believe, what's underlying the real motivation of doing it, of not being able to have a school district that can produce any college-ready students. It's very apparent what's going on here. But the other part of it is that what I'm trying to do as an elected official under emergency management, and I hope that others who are in a similar situation would be the first ones to come back from it with full rights of governance, because emergency managers come and go, but when they leave, the people are not re-empowered. They're under a financial review board of the state, and it's very unequal than what white districts and municipalities have. It basically puts black municipalities under a review board that white municipalities are not under.
Well, so this has happened. I mean, the city of New Orleans is a very good example of that. This ethnic cleansing, this educational genocide that you have been talking about, where there isn't a single public school left, really. It is all privatized, and that doesn't mean that the educational opportunities have improved.
That's actually, no, they've gotten much worse. They've gotten much worse, but that's their goal here. Even the same people are in on it.
You have the same situation about ready to just explode in the city of Chicago. And that educational system under direct fire, and the schools that are being systematically closed down, an effort, as you say, to basically ethnically cleanse the city.
Right.
You see it all across the country. So why hasn't the educational community been more robust about getting this message out? There's something afoot here on the order of a catastrophe that is happening right before our eyes on so many levels. In your case, it has to do also with the authority of the people who have elected you and others to a school board, and the school board has no power, wiped out by court order, the imposition of emergency managers who eventually become the only legal authority empowered to do anything, and the decisions that are being made in this context are lethal to the people. So why aren't we hearing more of a hue and cry about this trend?
I'm telling you the reason is because it's black people. I never ever would have thought that or felt that before I got on the Detroit School Board. I've been here in Detroit my whole life. I've been involved, I've been an activist my whole life. I did not know what anti-black racism was before I got on the Detroit School Board. I did not know the antipathy, the genuine, genuine disdain for black people. I didn't know. I swear I didn't know. And I still don't have the words to describe it, but I'm telling you that you can do anything you want to black people in this country. That's basically what the message of Snyder is. And Duggan, you can do anything you want to black people in this country. Duggan became mayor without being on the ballot? Really? A white man in a black city, it's an 85% black city. He was not loved. He was not popular. He didn't live here. He had no, you know, I'm not saying no white person could ever get elected, but he didn't have any relationship to the people. None. None. But he was brought in by the very same forces that are doing this. His highest donor was Richard Baird, who was Snyder's highest donor, the governor of Michigan, who's doing all this. He was the one that brought Duggan in with millions and millions of dollars in campaign contributions. And the media, which, you know, said, yeah, we can have a write-in mayor. This was impossible. It was impossible. I went to the recount every day. I saw for myself how they did it. Many people went to the recount. Mainly we wanted to know that Detroit did not elect this person. And I felt better for knowing it. But that just, it's just really, it's a racialized narrative, and it's, I think, of everything, I think that race is the most intractable sort of injustice that there is.
So what is an appropriate, I know what you're doing, you're fighting, and others are fighting alongside you, and thank goodness for that, but what do you expect the reaction to be, or what should it be? How could people basically defeat this?
Well, there would have to be a movement like there was an anti-apartheid movement or the voting rights movement, you know, the voting rights of pre-civil rights. It would have to be like that. But I think in order for that to happen, we would have to be able to know, people across the country would have to be able to know that there are serious violations of not just voting rights, but people's governments have been taken over. and seized from them. And there's no real understanding of that across the country. We have people in Detroit, civil rights organizations in Detroit, that load up buses of school children from Detroit and raise money to go to the Voting Rights Museum down south. I'm like, you know, you could do that here and save the money. But they still think that it's somewhere else. People still believe that it's somewhere else. And they believe that the terrible situation of the schools is still somehow the responsibility of the elected school board. It's really, really hard to get people to understand it because we have the media that makes invisible any criticism except when there's something going wrong. Our names came up when all this corruption was exposed, like we were in charge. We have no authority. It's amazing what the media has done for this. It couldn't have happened without the media.
Elena, we are going to follow this, as you know, and mm-hmm. I thank you for just staying the course, and I thank you for what you do, and others who are similarly minded and who have a passion about what's going on in Detroit and are placing themselves on the front lines of the struggle. So I want to thank you for being with us and giving
much.
Us all this
thank
information
you.
To open
tell our listeners
eyes.
That I have my own radio program at 9:10 a.m. on
yes.
Sunday mornings from 6 until 8, and we rant about this. We have a lot of people involved in this struggle, and it's a two-hour talk show. And we also have Facebook, which is the official organ of the Detroit Public School Board in Exile.
Thanks so much for being with us today.
And thank
we'll
you
talk
so
again
much.
Soon.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks. We'll take a break and come back and talk about Sister Hillary having dinner in Detroit. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. I'm getting over a really bad cold. But I just had to share this with you because we're talking about Detroit. And I wanted to always make the case here that this isn't just a story. This is a warning. What's happening in Detroit, the coverage that we have been giving these various stories, is that these are warnings about the realities that we are living. And people are just not talking very much about them because they're very untidy. They're very boring. They're not sexy stories. But they are warnings about what eventually will come if there is no resistance to it. Well, presidential candidate Hillary Rodham Clinton had dinner in Detroit yesterday. She was the keynote speaker at the Detroit NAACP's Freedom Fund dinner just last night. So I thought I would give you an idea of how Sister Hillary continues to forge her relationships with the African-American community. This dinner had one main entree, I would call it, on the menu, total contempt. That was served with a side of condescension. But I'll share with you as much as you could stand, perhaps about 12 minutes of this speech. And lordy, lordy, if we survive it, we can have a little chat about what you have picked up about Sister Hillary. What else you have picked up about Sister Hillary when she comes to the people who are chiefly responsible for her viability as a political candidate. They also have, of course, been responsible for the viability of Bill Clinton's entire political career. But this is what she had to say. This was at the Detroit NAACP's Freedom Fund dinner. Sister Hillary.
I'll tell you what. That is an introduction second to none. I am so delighted to be here with all of you. This is the 61st annual Fight for Freedom Fund dinner. I remember very well when my husband attended this event back in 2000, the final year of his presidency, Dr. Anthony. He came home. He could not stop talking about it. He said, they call it a dinner, but let me tell you, it is so much more than a dinner. I saw that for myself 4 years later when I joined you as a senator representing New York. And I'm grateful to be invited back because, yes, this is so much more than a dinner. It's a celebration. It's a revival. It's a giant community meeting with people from all over the world. It's a movement. And you're right, it only happens in one place, right here in Detroit, Michigan. And I love Reverend Anthony's words for what does happen here every year. Not just this dinner, but a weekend-long issue-tainment. It's not just entertainment. It's not just talking about issues. It's both. I think America could use a little issue-tainment because there's so much we need to talk with each other about. We got to figure out how we're going to work together, like you had all those young people come in here and march around, literally representing their ancestry from every place in the world. I'd like to bottle that spirit, because if we can enjoy ourselves while we are trying to roll up our sleeves and work together and keep going for our communities and our country, we will be all the better off. So I want to thank the Freedom Fund dancers and the great speakers for their magnificent interpretation of Langston Hughes' poem, Let America Be America Again. They were wonderful. Thank you for sharing that with all of us. I'm delighted to be here with so many distinguished elected leaders, clergy members, business and union leaders, and so many people from not just Detroit, not just Michigan, but literally across our country. I want to thank all the elected officials. I'm particularly pleased to have this chance also to congratulate all of the award winners, starting with Congressman Clyburn, who is a deserving recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award. And I want to also recognize Senator Jeff Hansen for his award this evening. Mary Sheffield, Ivy Bailey, Shaka Singar, and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Jefferson. These are extraordinary Americans who deserve the recognition that you have given to them. I gotta admit, though, after that introduction, in that typical low-key style, I'm a little bit worried I am gonna shirk. Because I gotta say, you got me all worked up about what we can do together based on where. And I want to start where the Langston Hughes poem took us. I appreciate the chance to hear that poem with new ears. I've read it many times. But as with all great works, there's always something new to discover. And for me, what stands out tonight is that line right at the start. Let America be that great, strong land of love. That is more than poetry, my friends. That's a prayer. It's one I hope we all try to carry in our hearts every day, especially in this wild political season. This election represents such a critical choice for America. Yes, of course, it's a choice between different candidates, different parties, different platforms, and visions for America's future. But I think it's also a choice about something even more fundamental. It's about unity versus division, compassion versus selfishness, and love versus hate. The stakes don't get much higher than that. So we've got to do everything we can to convince Americans to make the right choice. America has come a long way over the past 8 years, and I don't think President Obama gets the credit he deserves for everything he's done to rebuild the economy and make life better for American families. And no one knows that better than Detroit. Look at what's happening across this great city, in Midtown and Eastern Market, Southwest Detroit. Buses are running, new businesses are opening, families are moving in. There's a palpable feeling of pride and progress, Mayor. And meanwhile, the auto industry just had its best year ever. I think it was a pretty good investment America made in saving the auto industry and giving the auto companies, the UAW, and the auto workers a chance to show that Americans can compete and win. Innovation is on the rise across Michigan, the clean energy sector, the defense corridor, and so much else. So day by day and week by week, the people of Detroit and Michigan are doing what you've always done, making and designing things that America needs and the world wants. But we can't be satisfied until the economic revitalization we're seeing in some of Detroit's neighborhoods is felt in all of Detroit's neighborhoods. We can't be satisfied until every parent has a good-paying job and every grandparent has a secure retirement. We can't be satisfied until all of Detroit's children are learning in good schools with good teachers in every classroom and no crumbling ceilings or mold or rats scurrying across the floor. And we can't be satisfied until all of Michigan's families have clean water to drink and bathe in. We know what happened in Flint is unacceptable. We've got to make sure that kind of disregard for the lives of children and families is never allowed to happen anywhere else ever again. I'm grateful to Mayor Weaver and the leaders in Flint for their leadership. They're shining that bright light. We're working together to make sure America can't ignore the families of Flint and to put young people to work helping distribute clean water, broken pipes. And President Obama's visit this week.
I can't take it anymore. I can't take anymore. I don't want to subject you to much more of this. But you listen to Sister Hillary speaking very slowly and very loudly. You know, the way people speak when they think they're talking to idiots. And they believe that by slowing down and by bumping up the volume, they would actually be heard. And listen. But did you notice the southern twang in the voice there? Every time, she says. Every time. Many times. I say, my goodness. It sounds almost like she was, you know, a little, how should I say, a little happy. Maybe she had a sip or two of wine before the speech, but she was speaking, and you wondered, how do you compare this speech to the typical Hillary Clinton speech when she's talking, you know, to really smart, real people? You spend all this time congratulating people about the issue-tainment. And how are we gonna work together? And congratulating the Freedom Fund dancers? Obviously, what I'm getting at here is twofold. We have one of the leading civil rights organizations in the country, the Detroit branch of this organization, the NAACP, having clearly a presidential candidate, and by choosing her over any other, one would automatically assume that it is an implicit endorsement. But she has nothing to say. Because obviously there is no demand from this organization at all. And she is quite safe in being totally noncommittal, very general, very blasé. She is there simply to be seen among the peeps. And here we have a problem. Because we just finished hearing about a whole other Detroit. Elena Herrada just told us about a whole other Detroit and a whole other reality that occurred today, the very next day after Hillary Clinton's big-time speech in Detroit. And you wonder, well, wait a minute, was this a form of some kind of amnesia that set in, or is it that people just refuse to accept the reality of Detroit? Or is it just a continuing contempt, self-contempt on the part of the NAACP and others? Self-contempt. There is no way that Hillary Clinton could have gone before AIPAC and not addressed seriously from the word go what the organization expects her to address with respect to Israel. She's not going to do that. There is no way Hillary Clinton would go before an organization, a women's organization, and not address from the word go those things she thinks are priority items for women. But she comes to Detroit, an embattled city by any definition. We just heard the report from Elena Herrada about what's going on in Detroit. We have been hearing about Detroit on this program for more than 2 years. And it doesn't factor in much, except for the most recent public relations issues, like the Flint water crisis. But it's not a water crisis, as we know. Elena Herrada is correct. These are genocidal policies. And she talked about Detroit as a living, breathing example of apartheid. That's what she's saying. She's lived all her life in Detroit. And yet this organization, this African-American organization, invites Mrs. Clinton, and it's all about making nice. I gotta say, you got me all worked up, she says. Oh, I gotta say it, all this nonsensical, condescending, literally racist and condescending address that she gave there. And people ate it up. They loved it. She was with them. She selected to be with them. They had no idea that the job really was simply to be there, to be seen as being hosted by one of the oldest and most respected so-called civil rights organizations in the country, and to make her pitch for, you know, the vote. So we see two interesting things going on here. Self-contempt, where the leadership just doesn't get it. Because they've been bought and paid for, they don't even demand their customary 30 pieces of silver. They wouldn't even take one if it came to it. They offer themselves for free. They take their various constituencies, and rather than fight for freedom, they bring them back to the auction block. And we have this so-called progressive, as racist as you could get. We've played her speeches before, and in every speech before African Americans, you find the same nub. That idea that she is doing black folks a grand favor by exploiting them. Look, the situation in Detroit, let's be clear, is a warning. And it's a warning having to do with the challenge to us as to how do we organize? What do we do? Because we cannot leave the solution to these systems and these people. They are clearly hell-bent on our annihilation. But we have to wake up. This is the message of Kwame Ture. You have the unconscious have to become conscious that they're aiding and abetting their own annihilation. As Elena said, every single black city in the state of Michigan is under direct control of the state. And yet people are talking about voting rights. This is a woman who comes to say, give me your vote. She is not interested in the usurpation of people's voting rights.
She's interested only just get there and cast your vote for me. Which is why I say, why do you bother with this business of voting? It is such an insult. And people have a duty, it seems to me, all across the country, in service to and in support of the extended family, to exercise good judgment and leave this horrific system alone, get out of it, and begin the process of formulating something that directly addresses the communal good, the aggregate need. There is a total collapse here of loyalty to community, to ideals. You're quoting Langston Hughes and you're doing all these silly things because she understood correctly. There is no threat to Hillary Clinton. Black folks are no threat to Hillary Clinton at all. Quite the opposite. They're falling over themselves to see how else they can bring her into the fullness of her entitlement as a white woman in America who agrees with all the racist principles that have been in existence this long and whose conduct continues to remind us that she isn't too far away from those deep Arkansas roots, or roots, as I might say. Same city, two entirely different points of view, two entirely different treatments. What are we going to do? That's the continuing question on this program. I thank you for joining me today. I encourage you to stay tuned to PRN.FM. Pass the word about this great station. Coming up next, the Global Research News Hour. It's a news hour like none other. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. But don't forget the lessons of today. Bye-bye.